Okay, this is Amber Duke. I am interviewing Shamika Parrish Wright on Tuesday, June 21st, a little after 11 a.m. at the Carl Braid Memorial Center on Broadway. Shamika, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
And just for the record, can you acknowledge that I gave you a consent form and you understood and signed that?
Yes, you did. You gave me a consent form and I signed and dated it.
Okay, great. Can you say and spell your name for me?
Shamika Parrish Wright, Shamika Parrish Wright, Wright.
Okay, thank you. Shamika, can you tell me when and where you were born?
Cincinnati, Ohio, January 3rd, 1977.
And we can get into the longer version of this story later, but can you just give me the short version of how you ended up here in Louisville?
Here in Louisville or at the Alliance? Here in Louisville.
Here in Louisville.
Here in Louisville was I was on my way to Jacksonville, Florida, for a position. And then because I was a single parent with three children and I was actually expecting at the time, I thought it might be good to try to move out of state to somewhere that was a little more local, closer to Cincinnati. And that way, if it didn't work or I found it to be hard after a year or so, I could just go back to Cincinnati. So Louisville was a test city. I had been down here to party for Derby. I had come to several events here. And it was far enough away from Cincinnati to give me that out-of-state move feel. And it was also close enough that I could go back and visit family and things like that. So it was a test city. I didn't give myself more than 2 to 4 years to be here. And so I came here in August of 2002. As a result of leaving an organization that I worked for, I didn't like where that organization was going. And so everything fell into place and I was just like, it's time to go. So I came here.
Okay. You want to talk about your educational background a little bit?
My educational background as a non-traditional student is has been a lot of highs and lows. I actually went to Taft High School. I was a teen mom. I had my daughter when I was 15. I did go back to school and stay another 2 years, but by the end of my junior year, I was very frustrated with school. I was frustrated with school work and dealing with a lot of the students because I had to mature very, very fast. And it was just, there wasn't a lot of resources for teen moms who kind of probably didn't need to be in that setting. I know here in Louisville, they have a TAP program, but they didn't have it in Cincinnati. You just went right back in population. And I just kept having challenges with that. So I left school, and I got my GED, and I got my GED actually in June 1995, and that was when I was supposed to graduate. So I got it at the same time. I went to college in September. I did have a scholarship before, because I was always in college prep classes, and so I had some college offers before. But then after I got pregnant, I didn't want to travel to Cleveland or Columbus to go to school. So I stayed in Cincinnati and went to University of Cincinnati in 1995 under social work, kind of social work, social sciences, and did that off and on from 95 to about 2000. I always worked and went to school, and so there was times where in between when I had children or had issues with the children, I had to leave school and come back. So I did that at the University of Cincinnati about 2 or 3 times. And then I came here in 02, and I went to JCC in I worked for a while, and I went to JCC, I think, in 2004. And I graduated from JCC with a human services degree in 06. And then I went to the University of Louisville in 06, the end of 06, in fall of 06. And then I've just been in and out of University of Louisville. When I was planning to relocate to Florida, I did go two semesters to University of Phoenix because it was cheaper for me to do that than to move to Florida and still be considered an out-of-state student. And so now I'm three classes away from a bachelor's in psychology. And so I just need to go back and finish those three classes, which are statistics and college algebra and the PAS 100 class. So
that's well, at least the PAS 100 will be fun.
Exactly. I saved the math for last. Yeah. Right. So.
Okay, well, can you briefly describe your professional background? You've been working for some time.
Yeah, I've been working. I worked as a skilled worker. I always find that term interesting. I've been working since I was 13. I've had a lot of jobs since. So it's been like daycare to factory worker to hospitality worker to administrative. What else? I'm trying to sum them all up. I worked at an amusement park at Kings Island for a while as a cashier. And then I say about maybe 97, 98, I started working for a nonprofit organization that did community work. And then I really really got turned on by that work. And so I started working as an organizer back in 1999. And ever since then, I've just been doing, like, sometimes I do consulting work with different organizations. Sometimes I do fundraising work. Sometimes I work as an organizer like I did for the Kentucky Alliance. And this other company I work for in Cincinnati, organization, Kaleidoscope. I did work around gentrification there. And then I did a lot of service-based stuff. It wasn't until I came here to the Kentucky Alliance that I didn't... Well, I think the gentrification was politically based, but it still had a service-based component. But coming to the Alliance as a human service student, intern, gave me a lot of experience with the political realm. And so I've done a lot of work. So...
Well, kind of moving ahead a little, well, sort of moving backwards, actually. What do you remember about first learning about race and racism?
Wow. That was a question that was first posed to me in that sense by Ann Braden and while taking her class at U of L in 06. But before then, I mean, I identify as a black woman, and so I've definitely had... a lot of experiences and a lot of questionable experiences with dealing with race and even dealing with intercultural racism because of I don't consider myself to be light-skinned, but some folks do. And so dealing with that. So growing up, we talked about racism, but it was always one-sided. It was like white people hate black people and then that's it, you know. And so it was hard for me because I had so many friends that identified as white or mixed. And so I found it challenging to just automatically hate white people. And so that made me stand out in my family because everybody's like, you're just weird. And why do you want to have all these white friends and stuff? So I had to deal with that a lot. I was, you know, being called weird and being called crazy and... because I just didn't automatically hate a lot of white people. When I read the history in school and things like that, I was upset and I thought about the people who actually committed those, you know, the things that I read about. And I didn't like that. But I felt like a lot of the people I was dealing with were generations and generations from that. So I didn't feel that same, anger. And that caused problems because, you know, people... When you're like that sometimes in the communities I was in, people think like, oh, you just, you know, maybe you want to be white or maybe, maybe you just don't understand the past or understand what racism has done. Maybe you're just blinded, you know, it's just all types of stuff. And so, and then just, I just had to really think back, because a lot of my hurt and pain came from people of my own color. And so, you know, being abused and so many accounts by people of my own color, it didn't reinforce, like, you should hate white people. It just was like, people do some jacked up stuff. And it's people who do that, you know, and I didn't look at it like that. So when in 06, to fast forward, I was taking this class. It was actually a 500 level class that Aaron was teaching through some program at U of L. And I took the class, and in that class, she asked the same question. And so I started thinking, and I was like, when did I first deal with racism that I can really say that was blatant racism? And I started thinking back, and I thought it had to be when I was like 13, and, well, maybe 12 or 13, and I had a friend, her name was Amy, and her sister name was Charmaine, and so Amy was we went to school together. She was like my best friend. Her sister Charmaine was kind of seen as a pariah because she was white, but she dated only black guys. And so a lot of the black women in the community didn't like her because she only dated white guys. And so Amy and I would talk about, like, the things that they had to deal with, the name calling and all that stuff, as a result of some of the actions they felt like her sister did. And so one day, Amy wasn't around. I think she went to visit her father. And her sister was, you know, like, hey, Shamika, you want to go to the store with me? And I was like, okay, yeah, I'll go to the store with you. So we got on a bus. We went to the store. And we walked around. I bought some things. I was assuming she bought some things because she separated and went to other departments. And so, but by the time we were supposed to meet up, because our bus came at a certain time, so we were supposed to leave and go get back on the bus. And as I went to get on the bus and went to the exit door, these security people came and got me and took me downstairs where she was already waiting, sitting at a desk. And I guess this is where they took people that had issues in the store or whatever. And I get in there, and it felt weird. I get in there, I sit down, and they're like, we're sitting at a table similar to this, and they're like, hey, you know, they have her bag, which is the bag she was carrying was my bag, because they had, like, Malcolm X. It was back in the day when we wore the medallions, you know, and I don't know if you remember, but we wore in maybe late 80s, early 90s, we wore a lot of African pride stuff. So it was like you have Africa on your little side pouch and you have the little red, green, and yellow medallion and all of that stuff. So it was clearly my bag. And but she had asked, could she carry it when we got off the bus and we went in a store? So they dumped it out and they dumped all this stuff out. And they were like, we know that you taught her how to steal. We know that this is all you. And I'm like, what? She carried my bag. And that is my bag, but that's not my stuff in the bag. I mean, they clearly got the bag from her. And she was just sitting there. Like, she didn't say anything. And they just did all the talking. So when Ann asked me this question and I thought back, I was like, wait a minute. The store manager was white. The people that came and took us downstairs were white. The, you know, everybody was white in that situation but me. The police officers that came were white. Like, everybody. And here is a person that we weren't the best of friends, but I figured, like, you asked me to come to the store with you, and you're, like, stealing. And then you're going to, like, let your stuff be my stuff. And because it was so over a certain amount, she got charged with, like, petty theft. But they charged me with theft because it was over $100 or whatever. And I was like, I was so angry. So we get in the car, and she, like, still doesn't say anything. And I'm like, how can you not say nothing? You know this was your stuff, you know? And I just was really upset. And I went to the juvenile detention center, and we were put in these cells, and I just really wanted to, like, beat her up. I'm not going to lie. And I didn't even want to be handcuffed to her. It was that bad. And so we get to the place, and my mom's like, no, your ass is stealing. You're staying in there. Her parents come get her. She's out of there, like, within an hour. I got to sit in there for, like, 2 or 3 days while we go to court and all of that stuff. And I just was like, I didn't understand it. And the first thing my mother says when we go to court and we get home, it's like, I told your ass, you always want to hang with white people, you know? And I was like, what? You know? So, even then, I didn't build up any hate. I just was like, okay, I'm not going to hang with Charmaine anymore. So, yeah, that was my first, that I can just be, like, really conscious about, that there were some elements of racism in that.
Mm-hmm. What about political and social issues? What did you learn about those kinds of things when you were growing up at home?
Well, we talked about everything. If it was on the news, or if it was in the paper, or if Johnny down the street was harassed by the police, we talked about it. And it was always like, you know, that's messed up, you can't do anything. And we were just taught to be really, like, you know, do what you want to do. But when you see the police coming, or you walk by a white person, be prepared for them to put their purse up or move to the other side, or be prepared to be harassed by the police. And so it was more like survival techniques. It was more like, here's how you need to survive because these social issues exist. This is how you need to survive. So, you know, my mom, she was born in 57, so she dealt with a lot of stuff, and, you know, where you couldn't go to certain neighborhoods and you couldn't cross the bridges and stuff like that. And so all her experiences were just the worst. She had never had, she had never had a decent experience with a white person. And so everything was just like, oh, they're all racist. They all are out to get you. And so you need to be cautious. And especially for the black men in our family, or in my brother, it was like, you know, the gun's really pointed towards you, so you really better act right. And so it wasn't a lot of in-depth discussion. It was a lot of survival techniques.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about a person or people who inspired you as you were growing up?
Several. My mother is very spiritual. She has a lot of Native American in her, and we went to church, like, on Easter and stuff like that. But she didn't make us go to church every Sunday. She didn't make us go to church at all, except for when she went, and that was rarely. So I wanted to understand church. And so there were some neighbors who lived across from me. I had to be about 11. And there were some neighbors that lived across from me who I see every Sunday going to church, and every Wednesday going to Bible study. And so I just went over there and asked them, could I go to church with them? One of them, the husband, happened to be a security guard at my school. And so, you know, I was really inspired that, you know, after dealing with all of that stuff he dealt with at school, that he just wanted to, like, get up and, like, go to church and do stuff. And he still was a family guy. And I really liked that. And so I went to church with them for a long time. And then because my childhood was, like, really crazy, I saw more people that I didn't want to be like than people that I wanted to be like. And so, but there's been, like, I'll hear stories about my grandparents. I've never met any of my grandparents, but I'll hear stories about them and things that they did and ways that they stood up for people or did stuff. And then that, they inspired me, just the stories of hearing how they were. But it probably wasn't until I was older, maybe about 19, that I met a woman. Her name was Jackie. She was, like, the first black woman to be manager of a post office. And she sold Mary Kay. And she had a baby at 15. And she went back to school and she finished school. And, you know, so I was really, really inspired by her. And I met her through the Church of Christ because I joined this church. And she just really inspired me. She was called my discipler, but it was basically when you're new and a younger Christian, they pair you with someone that is similar, and it's so that you can learn and understand from them. And it really made a difference in my life to meet her. It really gave me a vision, because everybody else that had children young you know, it was like you go to a certain level and become like just a worker and then that's it. You know, it wasn't a lot of, you know, other things to excel to in their lives. And so, yeah, she really inspired me. She didn't have as many kids as I did, but she had about 3 kids. And she, when she was telling me the stories that she had to go to trying to excel in the post office, I mean, you just don't even think about what people go through in a post office. And she was just telling me about the racism she had to deal with and how she had to be strong and, like, you know, and make sure she watches herself twice because people were, like, watching her and waiting for her to make a mistake. And so she was one of my major inspirations. And then through life, there's another lady I work for named Monique James who I worked for before I came to Louisville and who I didn't want to leave her organization because of her. But she kind of, like, she was out. She would take me to meetings and do grant proposals and all of that stuff. She took me under her wing and I learned a lot about nonprofit work through her. But what she would do is she would get all of that stuff. And then she had this organization that she ran it through. But her parents and her family, who were devout Jehovah's Witnesses, they ran it. And they discriminated against people. They just didn't treat people right. And that turned me off. And I hated to leave her organization, but I couldn't be a part of that. And so I made that decision. But she inspired me a lot. She's sharp. Another Black woman who had, like, just had to go through so much, you know. And then she was even, like, at missionary status in her Jehovah's Witness work, like, traveling all over the world to do that stuff. And then she fell in love with a woman. And when she fell in love with that woman, you know, she was cast out by her church. She just went through so many trials and tribulations, but just kept just persevering, kept, you know. And she was a big inspiration. I actually named my last daughter, I was pregnant when I moved here, Zakaria Monique, after her, because she just, she was just such an inspiration. She was really mad at me for leaving, but I just couldn't deal with that, like, that aspect of it, because that my name was going on paperwork, and people, a lot of the clients were coming to see me because they relate to me, and they knew that I related to them, and I just didn't like the way people were being treated, so I couldn't stay. So, yeah, she was one of them, and then I came here, it had to be 05, it might have been the end of 04, about 05, and met Anne. You know, and it's like all these different walks, and then I meet these phenomenal women, and I didn't look at it, you know, now that, you know, as the years go on, I become more educated, because I'm 34, and I'm still like, I feel like a freshman in college, you know, because it's so much to learn, you know. But I met Anne, and I was just so inspired, because I had called here, you know, and I had called to do the internship. Because there was this list, I always tell people that, there was this list of organizations that JCC gives you to do your internships, and at the bottom of the list was, like, the Kentucky Alliance Against Racism and Political Repression. And my counselors, the Human Services Department, when I chose everybody was going to, like, Wayside and Healing Place and all the service-based places. And I was like, you know what, I don't want to go. And they were like, Shamika, you can do so much, you know, just watching you as a student. And they were like, are you sure that you want to go to this organization? I was like, well, it's on the list. It's got to be. And they said nobody had really, they had just, the Alliance had been on the list for a little bit, but nobody had really shown a lot of interest in going. And then the lady, she was an avid volunteer and donated to the Alliance who, I think Joanne Shoemake, she had said, well, Shoemake, I'm going to tell you, I volunteer with the Alliance, I donate to the Alliance, but it's a different kind of place. But I think it's interesting that you want to go, and we need more human service professionals to go towards the political realm, and so if that's what you want to do, do it, you know. So I had all these warnings, and then I was like, you know what, I want to check it out. I don't know why, it just stuck out off the paper, and And I do that sometimes. I just float with the spirit. Like, the spirit says, this is it. And this is going to be it. So I chose, and they were like, call them first and set up with something. So I called, and Alice was still with us, and she answered the phone, and I was like, I'm interested in coming. Even she was like, are you sure you want to come here? And like, why? And I was like, yeah, I want to come take you. She was like, well, all right, well, you come in, and if you hang around, and if you like it after, you know, a little day or so, then you can stay. And, you know, but come in and check it out. I was like, okay. So I come down here. We set up an appointment. I kept riding by, and like, because it didn't have that sign. It was just like, I kept riding by, and then I called her back, and I'm looking for this big office building or something. And she's like, no, we're in a house and blah, blah, blah. And so I was like, she's like, we're right before the overpass. So I just come down here and I come in, and it was like walking in back in time. When I walked in, it was like I walked right into like the 60s, 70s movement. Like it was just like stuff, you know, even the stuff that was on the walls, even the books that I saw, everything. Because I pay attention to all my surroundings, and I just was like, oh, okay. And Alice was like on the phone. We clearly had an appointment. I was actually on time. And I get here, and she just like got me waiting for like 20 minutes while she like clearly is gossiping on the phone. Like clearly. So I'm sitting there and I'm like, okay. And something's in me like, why are you here? Why don't you just leave? You know? And I was like, no, I want to see what it's about. And so I sat in a little foyer and just sat there for a while. And finally she got off the phone and she was just like, you know, if you want to hang out, come back, blah, blah, blah. Here's what we do and this and that. And then that was it. She was like, come back the next day. I come back the next day. Apparently Ann had been teaching at EKU, I think. And I come back and she's here, right? And she's like, you know, like on the computer. And she looks above her glasses. She's like, who are you? I was like, well, I met with Alice. I'm a new intern. I'm really interested in learning about. All of a sudden, she gives me literally like a box like that full of stuff to read about the Alliance, full of brochures, full of. And she was like, and read that stuff, get caught up, and then the next day you're going to go down to the courthouse and meet and go and sit in on this hearing against the officer who had shot this man that was handcuffed in the back. And I was like, okay. So I went home and I was like reading it. And then I really became more engaged once I read like the history and read about Angela Davis and like how everything got started. I was just like, whoa. So I was just blown away by her when I first met her. So she was one of my biggest inspirations. It was the long way around, but I had to tell you that. So when I met her, I was just so impressed that this old white woman was like working on issues of racism and just tirelessly, and I just was impressed by that. I wanted to help her. I didn't know everything. I didn't want to know everything. I knew I wanted to help her and whatever she was doing, because I was like, dang, if she's doing that, the least I can do is, like, help, you know, so.
Well, and so I was going to ask you about how you first learned about the Alliance and how you became involved, so we've covered that. But, so, at some point, there was a transition that happened between you doing an internship and then you actually became an organizer for it. So tell me about the years that happened.
Okay. So that happened maybe, so my internship was only like, it was for a semester. And, you know, of course they had warned us, like, don't do the grunt work and don't do this. And it was ridiculous here. I did everything. I was here. Like I said, I was so inspired. I was learning so much that I wanted to be here. I was here 10 and 12 hours. I wasn't even supposed to be here like that. It was like I worked here. And I learned so much that I just wanted to keep coming and wanted to continue to help Ann. So immediately I came in, and Chris Phillip was here too. So she was more, like the administrative assistant. And Alice was more of the organizer. And Ann was here, was more like the background organizer. And I came in as to assist Chris initially. So my internship, they had me working with Chris and Alice. And so I liked that. And I found like some of the stuff interesting. But desk work, it tops out for me really soon. And so I wanted to do more like field stuff. So I asked Ann and Alice, you know, like, hey, if y'all got meetings or stuff you want me to go to, I want to get to know people. I want to, like, get to know the community, so I want to go to that stuff. And so that's what I started doing. When my internship ended, I still was coming in here, like, 40 hours a week, 40 to 60 hours a week. It was crazy, but I wasn't getting paid or anything. I did that for about 6 months. And then in, it had to be, so, 06, the beginning of 06. And they knew, I was like, well, you know, Ann, I got to find a job. What happened is I had taken the police exam in Cincinnati before and I did really well. And I did everything. I just caught a leg cramp at the last lap of the course. And so I had to redo everything again. Well, because when you do stuff like that, I guess it's a, it's like people can search and find like candidates and all of this other stuff. Well, New York Police Department and the Police Department in California were like contacting me. Plus, I had like put my resume and stuff out there because I had to find a job. I mean, I couldn't afford to continue to come here like I was and like try to have a job for the kids and stuff. So I just was like, I need to find a job. So I applied for TSA and I applied for several positions. And so what happened is some of those people started calling me. And Ann knew this, and Ann was like, you can't go be a cop, you know, and then she was like, you can't, you know, the thing with TSA for a year, even while I was interning, I was in a year process of getting hired with them, the transportation, you know, security folks, and I had worked at an airport before, so I had did all the clearance stuff, I did an agility test, I did everything, and but this was over a year, the year that I was in the internship, I was doing that as well. And got to the very end, and they were like, you did everything, but we can't hire you because you have more than $5,000 debt on your credit. Right. I was just so frustrated. I didn't know how to feel. Anyway, I came in and was spilling my frustrations out to Ann and just talking to her about what happened. And she was like, well, Shamika, maybe that's not in the cards. Maybe just, you know, you didn't need to work for them anyway, you know? And I was just like, I gotta have a job. So Ann put it to the board that, hey, you know, she's looking for a job. If we don't figure out something, we're gonna lose her, and she's a good asset to this organization. And then the board suggested, and then I guess somebody nominated us, made the recommendation, and then the board said that they wanted to hire me to come in. So when they hired me to come in, it was basically to help Alice, right? But I was doing most of the work in Alice because, you know, Alice had become comfortable with answering the phones and kind of being a 411 and kind of having her ear to the streets in that sense. And but I started like just pairing with her and going to do stuff. And it was working well. We did that for a while, but I really, it was kind of like Anne was like more directive about things. And then Alice more, like I said, she had become comfortable being a little more stationary. She would go to some meetings, but she wanted to kind of be here more. I mean, she had traffic coming in. Like she just had her own flow with people. And I, because I was still in the learning stage, I wanted to like meet all the people and like talk to folks. And so I ended up going out more, representing the Alliance. And so, yeah. So when I was hired on, it was only like $8 an hour. No benefits. It was just like, but I really wanted to be here. It wasn't the pay. I really wanted to be here. I needed some pay because I had to like, you know, take care of my kids. But I really wanted to be here.
Well, what were some of the major issues the Alliance was organizing around, you know, during that time?
During that time, it was that case where the gentleman was shot in the back by the police officer. It was doing a lot of work with the Newbie Network, mm-hmm. which developed after the Michael Newbie killings. And so being there, the network was going through a downslide, and it was just like, we need to talk and see what's going on and if we're going to continue this thing or not. What else? I think they had just finished the merger, because I think the merger happened right before I came here. They had just finished some stuff with the merger, but they were also kind of lobbying and talking to the representatives against the arena, the arena project, and education. Like, there was a lot of issues with the schools, with individual cases and things like that. And also, there was a influx of discrimination on the job discrimination stuff. So those were mainly the main things. They also partner with other organizations and their, you know, plights and struggles. So I did a lot of that coalition stuff, but those were kind of discrimination in the schools, discrimination on the job, police abuse, and kind of this strengthening this network with the newbie network and things like that.
So talk about that a little bit more. What's the Alliance's relationship with other social justice organizations here in town?
I think now versus then, I think now the Alliance, because of its history, has built up a name, a reputation. I think that now, though, people want to see more work on racism and political oppression issues. And so I think now people are more like, the Alliance should be doing this, the Alliance should be doing that. But they always call on the Alliance to sign on to things or to help get people out to things and things like that. That has always happened. It continues to happen. I think that the Alliance has, it's kind of like it's bubbling, it's ready to bubble over. I think that there's a lot of energy and people want the Alliance to do a lot, and then people within the Alliance want the Alliance to do a lot. But there's this direction thing, you know, which way are we going to do it and how we're going to do it. And that's been on question. That's been there since Anne passed. I think most people counted the Alliance out after Anne passed. And in many ways it should have been, because it was just so many struggles. And really, even when Anne was here, it wasn't functioning like an up-to-date organization. It functioned like it did in the 70s. And so that was phenomenal within itself. It still functioned on a shoestring budget of around $100,000, which is not a lot of money. And all of that, mostly 80-something percent of that, was grassroots fundraising, which is phenomenal. I mean, most organizations now are like grant-heavy. And so to have that kind of community support means that people believe in the work against racism and political repression. And so that energy has always been there. I think Anne just had such a stronghold. I think one of the things that people, when we talk about Anne, we always, you know, we talk about the good stuff, but there was also this other side where folks, they could have got more engaged, but they were kind of, they felt like they were pushed back or they couldn't come in and do some good work. In that sense, they only had to join in. They couldn't lead a lot of the work. And I think that wasn't Anne and Carl's idea. They wanted it to be led by people of color. But I think that like Anne would say, she still saw the world through her white eyes. Like, she still had struggles with control and, like, letting things be and, like, doing things differently. And that's still here. I mean, and that's not even just her. Like, it's still here because even with a lot of older black people, they tend to have more in common with somebody on a progressive end with somebody like Anne than they do with, like, new ways and new ideas of doing things. And so it's you know, some folks are working through that through intergenerational processes, but some folks I see struggle. And there was a lot of gatekeepers here, in that sense of people who, we, this works and let's do it. And then there's a lot of people who want to be acknowledged. And so they want to do a lot of press stuff. I don't come to that stuff. I'm on the board, but I don't come to a lot of that stuff because I'm not here to, like, be in the light. What happened is, because of my personality and my my will, I think folks were willing, so I won't just say willingness, but my ability to work across lines of difference, because my life has been filled with lines of differences, it kind of made me stand out more in the beginning. And I think that bothered folks. And even in a sense, Alice struggled with that too, because I was telling her, you know, because people, what I don't like about our local work, and I know it happens all over the nation and all over the country, is that there's a lot of like backdoor conversations. There's a lot of back talking, and I don't function that way, and I don't function well that way. And so, but I found myself in those situations when people were like, make comments about, oh, Alice falls asleep at our meetings, and Alice is not here. Alice don't, you know, I asked Alice to do this. And so that was starting to happen a lot with people in the community and with people within the organization. So Anne was kind of like this piece that's in between this table. She was like these people, you know, who want to get rid of Alice, and like they feel like she's outdated. We need to do this, this, and that. And then it was the new people who wanted to work with Alice, but they also wanted to bring in new people and do things different. And Anne was trying to like hold on to both. So I think when she met me, she saw me as a bridge person to do that. And I did a lot of that work. But then once she passed, those people who wanted to push Alice out really started moving forward with that agenda. Which is going to happen in this type of work. It's going to happen in these type of organizations. And so Alice's departure wasn't the best. Some of the volunteers' departure wasn't the best. I mean, some of them received a two-sentence thing, like, thank you, bye. You know, that was disheartening to me because I didn't want, that to happen to me in that manner. And two, I just feel like too much of the world uses people up and, like, throw them out. So, like, I feel like when we come into political organizations, we can't mimic that, you know. And a lot of times we mimic those bad things. So, yeah, it's Anne's death is a significant part of the Alliance's history. It would always be. It's definitely been a marker for a lot of things. But the Alliance, a lot of people like to associate the Alliance's downslope with Anne's death, but it started before then. It started before Anne because she was aging. She needed to let go of some things. Some other people needed to step forward. And that had, you know, she was kind of in the way of some of that process and progress because it's kind of like your baby. I think when her husband died, and she told me this, like, she just felt like, I got to do this. It really wasn't all like, oh, I'm just so motivated, I got to do this in that way because this work, I just totally want to believe in it. It's like, it got to work because, you know, this is what they did together. This is their baby. And they, you know, you don't want to see your baby go out and get hit by a car. Like, so you're going to protect your baby. And so I think that that's what it was. And Carl was a big inspiration to her activism, you know? And so it's like, I got to see this go forward. I got to see this center survive, and I got to see this organization survive. And so, you know, it's the downslope of the Alliance was way before then, was way before she died. It was already starting. I mean, like, the major donations we were getting were because of things that had happened in the past, or people who believed in her work, or people who were like, you know, aging too. And just like, I want to see you continue. And so she told me that people would give her $25,000, $10,000, just send her random checks and say, I just want you to use this for your work. She, in turn, turned a lot of that into things for the Alliance, and, you know, and she did some stuff with SCEP, but the things with the Alliance, she turned a lot of that money over. Even when she passed, she had, like, all kind of checks and things like that that she didn't even process, or because she didn't know how do I let somebody into this without losing what I have. And, you know, when you talk about money, things get crazy. And that's how it is at the Alliance. The Alliance can get a $2,000 grant and people go crazy. Like, for other organizations, that's nothing. But for here, it's everything, you know. So it's a hard place. And I felt like I came in right into the midst of that. And so for a lot of people, you know, some people saw me as a good marker for change and going in the right direction. But a lot of people saw me as, whoa, we can't let her, like, take over, or this mean white people. White people have always been involved. You know, people were saying that I want the white people, I want to help the white people take over the Alliance. And I pushed back at a board meeting and was like, white people have always been a part of the alliance. Like, white people have always ran things. Like, I saw Ann tell Alice what to do and Alice go do it. I saw that many times. I saw Ann being the background person. I saw Ann writing a lot of things and Alice signed over. So I'm like, it's been happening. And my issue with them is that if you all had these issues with Ann, if you all had these issues, you should have brought that up while she was still with us. You should have, you should have figured out how you can make something happen while she was still with us. Now that she died, you want to point all that energy because you couldn't do these things or whatever, and you want to point it towards me. And so it got really toxic. And so I relied on my strength with the other organizations to kind of bring it back around. I relied on my strength, the building the strength within coalitions and working with the other groups. So I, you could call me and I'll be there to represent the alliance. I'll help. I'll take in volunteers. I'll send you volunteers. I'll get people out. And that's how that was easier for me to do because working internally out was very toxic. But so I found that I had more support from out in, from the people who kind of got the essence of it and wanted to still do their part. And so I used that energy and kind of brought it inward. And so that was it was challenging. And some people still hate me to this day for that. But I think that our strength, the alliance, when I think of an alliance, it means being aligned with organizations who are in some aspect, like we're working on racism, but homophobia is connected to that. Like housing issues are connected to it, environmental issues. So to me, our strength was working with organizations, and that had to be sustained in whatever way possible.
So, I mean, you've talked about this a lot, but I mean, this intergenerational piece I think is so interesting. And I mean, as you said, is not something that's exclusive to the alliance, but just it seems all over the country that there's this struggle of sort of like the changing of the guard,
yeah,
and people wanting young folks to be involved and say, wanting to teach them the history and tell them, and the complaints about young people aren't doing anything anymore. Right. You need to get involved. You need to get active. But then it seems when young people are involved and are active, it's like, wait, we don't want to do that. No, you're not doing it right. Let us do it. You need to learn from us. So, I mean, at this point in the Alliance's history, I know that the Alliance would do the summer youth camp, and I'm not sure the status of that. But, I mean, who are the young people that are involved in the Alliance? Are there young people involved?
Well, we have the children that were in the camps. Every day I get approached. Some of them are older now, but some of them are like, let's do the camp again, let's do this. Because I don't want to do anything halfway, and because we had a lot of internal issues with people taking like program stuff, people trying to get grants or trying to revamp things just so that they could get monies for them. And so because we had so much of that, it was hard for me to say, hey, Katrina's the administrative assistant. Katrina, here's everything I did with the arts and activism camp. Go ahead and do that. And like, you all take that and do that. I kind of got into my baby mode because after Bonnie Hines Hudson did it for 1 year, and then Ann recommended that I do it and continue to do it, it became my baby. Actually, because it was the last thing that she and I worked on. I left that weekend before she died. I left and got the grant into KFW. Late, and she was always late, but got it in there. And it was, and then, I talked to her that Saturday, and she's like, I'll see you Monday. And then to get that call Saturday evening, so it became my baby. It became my reason to stay, right? It became my reason to stay because I knew where things were going to go. Like, because I've been raised on survival mode, my instincts told me that once she passed, it was going to get crazy here. Right. And I was in the process. I was engaged to a ordained minister from Buffalo. And I was in the process of making that move. And Ann had talked me out of delaying it and just was like, he just got to come here and we'll find. And she was like hooking him up with ministers here. And like, he can get a church here. You don't have to go there. And So I was in this process of making a very big decision in my own life, and then to have this big thing that happened to an organization that I had come to love and fall in love with all the stickiness and everything else that came with it. And so I think that it was a pivotal moment. And so to me, the youth aspect was the most, it was going to be the hardest thing, because the Alliance struggled intergenerationally. They wanted to just instruct, you know. We just want to instruct the youth, and that's it. They didn't want no feedback. You know, I tell my mom, she was raised that kids are to be seen, not heard. That's exactly how most of the people were. That energy was still there. I couldn't hardly get any board members to be a part of the camp in the beginning. I got so much support from, like, people with outside of the camp that they had no choice to come and be a part of things, because all the energy was there, and they saw it, and they just came and but that was it. I couldn't get them to come and talk about, like, how they came into the work and all of this stuff. I had got other people to do it. And so it was like, we want the youth, you know, but then another member of the Alliance, she, who's, you know, is seen as abrasive and had some issues, she starts a youth thing because she gets a grant from the what is that, the city has the city of health and equity,
the Center for Health
Equity. Center for Health and Equity. Okay. They were offering these grants to community groups to do education around eating and community activism and stuff like that. And so she used a lot of my work to get the grant. She actually wanted me to sign off on a paper. I did it because I didn't want to look like I was standing in the way, but it was totally like my application, like everything that I had developed. She copied a lot of that. She changed the curriculum and a little bit and got the grant, and then the whole board was supportive of that. But those same people didn't support the camp, which had been productive, which has had at least 2 or 3 years of success, growing success. Like, we started out with 12 students, and then we got like 50, and then 80, and then 90, you know. And I was just like, what, you know? And so that to me was an intergenerational thing. It was there. And so I called that out. And people were upset with me, and I was like, well, where are the youth? You know, and they talked to me about older youth programs, but those were more like, we instruct you. It's not like the youth are able to come back and like do something or give something back. And so I think that that's an issue when we talk about intergenerational. When you were saying that, when you were talking about it, how it's there, people, I remember talking to Ann about it, because she saw some of the stuff that was going on, and Ann was like, Shamika, you all keep waiting for people to just have to hand it to you. They're not. You got to take it respectively. And it was true, you know. But a part of me was upset, because I came here to learn. I wanted to learn from these people. Like, I didn't want to do that. Like, because I didn't feel as encouraged, because one, I wasn't from here, you know. And two, it was just like, okay, how could I just come in, you know. And then, but I wanted them to kind of give me a sign and say, this is okay. That didn't happen. And so it's just, you know, I think that Anne saw that too in herself. I would write things, and she would say, you know, you can't be, because I would give her something. She would like, do this flyer. I'll do it. Like I did it was before the Cornell West Day. I had did some flyers for her, and then she would get it, and she would like mark it all up, because, you know, she's a journalist. I'm not. Clearly not a journalist, but she would mark it up, and I'll just give it back, and then she'll give it back. She's like, you can't let your feelings get hurt. You write to speak to people, but I'm talking about engaging people to be active, and I needed that, right? And so it was good, and I loved when I got to the point, like when I did the Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, I did that kind of theme for the Cornell West. She really liked that, and I actually gave her a flyer, and it was simple. But it was just the words, and it was just enough words, and it wasn't too much, and she didn't mark up anything. And I knew I had come to a better place with that, And so then it just got to the point where she was like trusting me to do those things and I would do them. And so I think that that's what a lot of people want when they work with people. And she would also get frustrated too when we would do the classes and then I'll pick her up or whatever. And she'll be like, I just don't understand. I give people all these pages, because she would give us a ridiculous amount to read. And she would give us all the stuff to read. And we get there, and, like, people just want to hear her tell this oral history of, like, because she's there. She's been there. Like, and she would say, Shamika, why do I give all this stuff to read? Nobody reads it. And then I come there, and they all, like, their eyes are glued to me. They, like, listening and hanging on to every word I say. I say, and because you kind of, they see that you as a person that's been there and done that. And they know that they can always go back and read, you know, but they know this moment right here of talking to someone who's like in the flesh has done it is powerful. And they would rather do that. I'd rather do it, you know, but I read because I work for you and I can't just, you know, but, you know, so she just was frustrated too. I think it's a struggle. I think that, you know, our society caters to what you gotta be. Either if you're not a youth, like 18 and under, really 19 to 50, all products, most products and things like that, that's what it's catered to. And so I think that a lot of people feel like they're, you know, even in this work, and I hate that they feel like that in this work, but they feel like they're not valued. And so then when they have this new energy coming in, it's like, oh, it's my turn. I think that this movement has created a lot of, you know, when it's my turn type of people. And because, you know, I'll wait and then when it's my turn, I'll shine. And so now, because we're like constantly trying to bring more energy in and not having this hierarchical system, that people are intimidated by that. And they're like, wait a minute. When Ann died, I was supposed to be leading an alliance. When Ann got sick, I'm supposed to do this. Or when Tom gets sick or Bob Cunningham dies, I'm going to be that one that they invite to stuff. And so they feel like if you're a new person and you come in and you kind of garner that same attention or whatever, oh, people were pissed that I spoke at the Ann Brayton, the first Ann Brayton thing. I liked it because Kate kind of had like three different areas, like, of Anne's life. Like, it was, like, I'm forgetting his name. The guy that was over the NAACP.
Julian Bond.
So, the Julian Bond event. So, it was, like, Julian Bond. Was that Al Herring that spoke, too?
Mm-hmm.
Al Herring spoke first, right? Then Julian Bond, and then me, right? People were, like, livid. Because they were, like, uh-huh. Even though I had something to share, because I had the least amount of time with Ann, but I had worked with her tirelessly for the last year and a half of her life, people were like, because they felt like that was out of place. Mm-hmm. And that's an intergenerational issue. Mm-hmm. Like, why can't we represent these different areas? I thought it was great. It was great. It was a very successful event. More people were very positive about it than negative, but those negative people were here and they were on the board here. And I came back to work like that next week or whatever. Oh, it was just like, it was attitudes. It was, you know, and it just got to the point that at board meeting, I was like, you know, this, you all should have been spoke up. You all should have, don't put all that energy on me. This is not my fault. Like, I came in here to learn. I came in here to learn from you. I came here to talk to you. And I came to bring what I have to offer too. And if you had these issues, they should have been dealt with. So it's been taking some time. I had to go even beyond that. I had to really, to do a lot of intergenerational work, I had to go and like talk to some main staples in the community, like Rhonda Mathis, Reverend Coleman, who else? Maddie Mathis, like, what's her name? Maddie Jones. Like, they, and even people like Lawrence Winburn, like, I was getting word back from, like, other older people who were kind of at this moment of, like, I want to invite a younger person in here to do this stuff. I understand the plight of trying to do intergenerational work, and I don't want to stand in the way of that. And they were all 50 and over. But they were coming back and telling me, like, some of these main people were, like, the main people in the community. And people on the board, like, the chair and all that, were people who were kind of slandering my name in the community. And saying all these, I want white people to take over the Alliance stuff. I couldn't have that. Like, to me, that was not productive to community work. And I couldn't do that. So, I went. They would invite me to stuff, right? Because they want to invite me to stuff. I go. And I will pull them to the side, like, you know, this is what I heard. I really would like you to get to know me for yourself and don't make these assumptions. Yes, I got 4 kids and 4 baby daddies, but that doesn't mean that I don't care about this work. Like, it was stuff like that. She got 4 kids and 4 baby daddies and this and that. You know, like, it was crazy. And I pulled Coleman to the side. I pulled all of them to the side. And I was like, I just don't work like that. If you want to know me, you can get to know me. Come and be a part. Come sit in on the camp. Come here, the office, hang out. Spend some time with me so that you can garner your own understanding of me. This is just not helpful for any of us because you're going to need to call on me. I'm going to need to call on you. And I'm going to need to know that you are calling on me in good faith and not just because, you know. And at first, they were surprised. And second of all, they were just like, okay, you got to keep doing what you do. Don't worry about that stuff. You know, it was all that, you know. But I was just like, no, I can't work like that. I don't work like that. And I'm not going to work like that. And if you're going to have to try to have relationships with me, then it's going to be as genuine as possible because I don't want to, you know. And then it got to the point where Coleman, it was good. He called me, him and Dick Gregory, when they wanted to write a letter to the Queen Elizabeth. They were like, can you write this letter for me? They took the letter, you know, they didn't credit me, but they put the Justice Resource on top of the letter and submitted and, you know, copied it and submitted it, you know, but they asked me to do it, you know. So to me, that means a lot. Like, you know, when Coleman was going to Georgetown for the, they said the gentleman had hung himself or whatever, he called me. He called, like, can you get some people down here? Can you get some young people here? You know, and that meant not. Rhonda Mathis, we were going to Cincinnati to the, you know, they have a slavery, like, museum up there. They just built
the Underground Railroad.
Underground Railroad. Mm-hmm. And so I was taking the camp youth there, and Rhonda wanted to go, you know, for free and just to be a kind of a chaperone. And she went. And on the way back, she was like, I have to apologize to you. I was one of those people that was out here. I didn't know everything. I'm going to tell you that there was some people on your board who was starting this stuff, and I just kind of played into it. I had to get to know you for myself. I talked to Bonnie and some other folks who had worked with you, and they were like, no, you need to know it for yourself. And she was like, I'm glad I did that. And it's been a great relationship ever since. So I think that, you know, not that I have some miracle recipe. I just knew that I couldn't work under certain conditions. And I know that the intergenerational factor is so important to me. And I told them at board meetings, I said, I'm just at that age where I give a damn enough to take a lot of your bull and try to make some sense of it. You know, but you're losing. That gap with this other generation is growing wider. You know, and it's not going to be a lot of means that come through here who's going to sit through these meetings and be blatantly disrespected, who's going to do all of this stuff because they believe in the bigger part of the movement. And a lot of people are going to do that. So you have to do something and knuckle down and don't just say youth for youth purposes. Don't have youth at the end of your agenda. Don't, you know, like, if you're going to really do this, you got to really integrate it. Yes, noise levels are going to go up when you have kids involved. Yes, things are, you're going to have to deal with that. Because, you know, a lot of times when stuff happened, it was a lot of youth that were a part of that. A lot of youth that said, you know what, we're going to sit at these counters or we're going to do this. And it was always a lot of people, you know. I had to have a personnel meeting before when it was a discussion about people kind of being like Uncle Tom's or like falling under like the white people, like doing whatever white people want to do or catering to white people or whatever.
Within the alliance, or
even in the local movement, saying that like certain white people with certain amounts of money run a lot of the work. So, and then we were in this personnel meeting because one of the things was, we want you to clip newspapers so you can be abreast of all the things that's going on. We want you to clip newspaper articles. I said, I don't read newspaper articles. I read my news online. Well, we want that to be in your job description. Because I didn't have a job description for a while. We want that to be in your job description, that you clip these newspapers and file them. And you read them and you look for the hottest issue. That's what Ann used to do. And this is what you should do. I was like, no, that's not. Why do I need to do that? You know, I can understand with understanding stuff, but I said that I read that stuff online. Why would I start? Why would I do that? So, and then this whole issue came up about, then somebody even suggested in a meeting that I talk and hang with black people. Somebody said that in a personnel meeting here at the Alliance Against Racism and Political Oppression, that I consider looking and talking to some black people and hanging with some black people. And it just got to a point where it was like, really? You questioning my blackness? And it was crazy. All because I know people that, I was like, do y'all know that I knew white people before I moved here? Do y'all know that I knew millionaires before I moved here? Do y'all know, you don't know anything about me. If you dare try to question my blackness to somebody in Cincinnati that knows me, they'd be like, what? Are you crazy? But here, it was questioned. That had never happened to me. I was blown away. I was just like, what? You know, I need to consider hanging with more black, a white person telling me that's within the organization and black people that I need to hang with more black people. And I said, what? So, you know, to me, those were clearly some issues. But what I found interesting is that Tom, who's been in this work a long time, and I know you've talked to Tom, he was like, Shamika, you know, I didn't want to say this in the meeting, but I'm going to say this to you, is that I've noticed over these 40 some odd years or 50 some odd years that when I'm typically, it's older black people who would be considered more of the Uncle Toms and who kind of follow the paths of like white people and things like that than it is younger. I found that more younger black people are more, a little more rebellious to that. And so I think that it's interesting that they want to think that you're like this when I don't see that at all. Like, over the years, I've seen this happen, but I've seen it happen with black people. Older black people. I was like, that's interesting. I don't want to, like, think about it in that sense, but I am offended when somebody, like, tries to question my blackness, you know. And I feel like this is an organization that's supposed to be against racism and political oppression. Like, you have to start within, too. That means inside of these walls, there should be no racism and political repression. And it turned my stomach sometime. I think now, I mean, the waters are better. There's, you know, some people have rotated off the board. Some people have did other things. And it's getting better, but it needs more direction. Like, I like the LGBT thing. I think it is something to consider. But I don't think that that's what the Alliance should be working on. But I'm one board member, and I brought it up at the board meetings, and I wasn't the only board member. But, you know, I brought that up at the meetings. I try to be, like, honest and truthful and say, hey, there's more issues that we can be working on. But people are worried, you know, and they're worried. But I said people, the reason why we still get donations, the reason why we can still sell out a unity dinner is because people believe in the work against racism and political repression. Like, people know that some organization has to be working on that 24/7 because it isn't going anywhere. Mm-hmm. And so people want to see that happen. And that's why people question, like, what is the Alliance doing? What's next? What's, you know, should the Alliance just give it all up and just let it go? Or is there a way that a direction that the Alliance can go in? And I think yes. I think that we need more strategic planning. I think we're in the process of doing that, but I think, yes, there's a lot more that can be done.
It's just growing pains. Yes. And it's, you know, it's hard when you're in the middle of the stretching to see to what it could possibly be on the other end.
Exactly.
Yeah. Just a couple more questions before we wrap up. I know that for a lot of your time that you were with the Alliance, you were a single parent, and now you're married. Mm-hmm. How has your family life been impacted by not just your work with the Alliance, but all of the work that you do in the social justice community?
My kids at first didn't understand why I spent so much time here. I would try to get them involved. I don't bring my kids to everything. They get to choose some of it. some events or programs or things like that, I make them come to because I feel like they can learn something or it's an educational piece. And so they actually end up enjoying those. Like we did the open house, when we do the camps, when we go and talk to people or be a part of like, you know, stuff the Institute has going on or anything like that in other groups that are related. And so they like that stuff. They don't always understand the struggle. Like I think they're in the process of what they're experiencing right now. And a big part of their discrimination and all of that stuff happens in school. Like it's related to the schools. And so they're kind of focused on that stuff, like the school stuff. And they don't always see the connections to like housing and other stuff like that. But once we talk about them, they understand them. So I think back in 05 or whatever, you know, they just was like, 04, 05, they were like, you know, hey, this is something mom's got to do. It's a job. I think now they understand it as a part of my life. And even if I was working for Delta again, I still would be doing activism. You know, like it's just, I've always been a part of my community, probably not in the same roles. Like now I'm a mayor appointed commissioner and all that other stuff. And I'm on several boards. But even back in the day when I was like in the hood, just growing up, I would like gather up all the youth and take them on trips. And I would, you know, get together and take them out to the library, do some studying. I just always did stuff, whether it was even if it was getting a streetlight fix. I was like writing letters to the council and going to council meetings, even back in Cincinnati. So I've always had a part of me that feels like I don't want to just live in a community. I want to be a part of a community. I believe in knowing my neighbors. And so I raise my kids that way. I raise my kids to say, hey, you know, before we even came here, they know to address people by their names. They had already dealt with people with different races. You know what I mean? Like they had all these experiences. I think coming here, they met more white people who are on the side of justice, which is different for them, you know, because they only had interaction with teachers and maybe some nasty cops, or you know, so they really got, they have a better understanding of people in doing this work because of my work, you know. So I think that that's really good. They're proud of me. They said they Google me in class all the time, and some of the kids Google their parents and nothing comes up, and they Google me and there's like 10 pages of stuff. And that they're proud of that. And I'm like, you know, some of that stuff I can get in trouble for, like going to Cuba and stuff. But, you know, they're proud of that stuff. And that makes me feel good that they, you know, that they, and they talk about me all the time. They said in school they're approached a lot because their friends see me on the news or they see my name in the paper or, you know, and so they're like, you know, recognizing that. And it actually makes their friends want to come to stuff. Like when we had the event up at the NIA Center and stuff, like some of their friends wanted to come and be a part of that. And so it's good. I think they're good. I think right now that I'm not working for an organization, they really like it. Cause I still go to meetings. I still travel and all of that, but I'm not like, I'm home more. Mm-hmm. I think that that's the struggle with trying to work and doing this work and being active and trying to be a good parent. I always tell people I wrote this paper when I was in Ann's class called Children of the Movement. And there's a gentleman who wrote a book about it. I think his name is Robert Blake, or well, I forget his name. But anyway, he wrote this book. He's an author out of Atlanta. And it's called Children of the Movement, where he went to interview Malcolm X's children, Martin Luther King's children. What's the guy named Zerwick? The guy that was on the bus, the Freedom Riders, the white guy that got beat up. He came off the bus first. I forget his name. But hell, his children, like all these significant people, Huey P. Newton, all these folks. And one of the things it says in the beginning is like, a lot of them said, we knew how to be activists. We didn't know how to be parents. And the reason why I wrote it because I was listening to Ann talk about the decisions that, you know, they had to make when they had children, you know, they had a child that died and all of that stuff. And I was just like, wow, I wonder how the children feel to like give their parents away to the movement, you know, basically their parents are. And I remember Martin Luther King's son in this book had made a comment like, people say I'm such a disappointment and I'm this and I'm that, but I never saw the dream my daddy talked about. All I saw is that my dad wasn't home, that, you know, I heard all these different stories and I never got it. And because I didn't get it, people see me as a disappointment. I remember Malcolm X's daughter was like, she went to college and she gets in her room and her roommate has got the room adorned and all this Malcolm X stuff and is running off all these facts about her father. And the man she knew was different, you know? And so thinking about that, so I'm just really working to make sure that the woman and the mom that my children know at home is different, that it shows that she was a lot of things, but that most important that she was their mother first. Cause that's, I mean, like, to me, how can I not be engaged when I have in JCPS issues when I have children in those, you know, like, and so making sure that I'm able to show the connections to my children, which is hard because some of the stuff they're like, so, you know, and I can see some of them who are going to go towards activism and some of them are like, no, deuces, you know, and Ann often joked about that with her kids, you know, they went in different directions and that's okay. And, she even helped write some of her kids' papers and stuff. And, you know, her son, I think her son went to Harvard or whatever, one Ivy League school. And she wrote his papers. I was here when she wrote some of her granddaughter and grandson's papers. Like, corrected them. They sent it to her. She would edit it and add stuff. So I'm like, so, I mean, I think we all just, you know, we find a way. We don't have a perfect system. And it is definitely no manual. There's many books about it, but there's no definitely, like, cookie cutter recipe to raise actively engaged, politically engaged youth. You want them to be, you know, but I think meeting them where they are, trying to be, you know, the parent you can be, and then showing them the connections is what I try to do with my children, you know. And I think most of them get it, you know, but some of them are like, you know, and they're going to be like that, you know. They want their mommy to themselves, and it is what it is, you know. So.
And you love them just as much. Exactly. Just the same. Is there anything that you'd like to share that you haven't had the opportunity to yet?
Wow, you not tired of me talking yet? just that my thing with, there was a youth group here and with that works with Ashley Jackson. They're doing that Reclaiming Our Youth, and I told them to stand up and say that they are in a movement. And I think that trying to instill in kids and just regular everyday people, I often tell people that, like, people who live on either side of this house or this building should know that what happened here or what's been going on, and telling people that they can get engaged. I don't think our movement is welcoming enough. I don't think people feel that they can just come off the street, walk in the door and spark some change, or we take their ideas and run with it, or, you know, I know there's risk and you have to calculate the cost and all of that, but I don't think our movement is inviting enough, and I think we're losing masses of people, and I think we got to figure it out. People don't like talking about marketing and movement, but I think our movement needs a lot more marketing. I think that if my child is, I'm riding in the car with her and she could tell me that on the rally's Kizmo bag, there's a little bitty miniature police officer. There's a little bitty miniature nurse and an army person. And every branch of the army in these little bitty figurine sizes on the bag. And she asking me in the back seat because she's reading, Mama, what's the arm? I never talked to them about the armed services. I never talked to them about the Navy. I never talked to them about the Air Force, none of that. But they know that stuff because it's marketed to them, mm-hmm. right, in some fashion. Why isn't it a little community organizer on there, you know? And why aren't our kids, like, why isn't it marketed to them? And we need to figure that out. We're losing, you know, like, our movement folks are getting older. You know, I always joke with Ann when she sent me to the women, what is the League of Women Voters? Mm-hmm. She sent me to one of their meetings, and I went in there, and it was like, I was the only black person, you know? That was obvious. And it was like everybody in there had gray or white hair, you know? And nothing's wrong with it. I love it. I hope to get to that, especially, you know, where I'm at. But I think that there's something happening. And people, you know, and I think there's a lot of issues within the movement. And that if I'm in survival mode, right, and I'm out in the streets making it, working 9 to 5, because people got this thing that people don't care, or people stupid on the street. People are not stupid, you know. They just come in and they see the bull and they're like, no, I'm not going to spend my time. Like, I shouldn't come into an organization and be repressed. And that's what happens. I shouldn't come in and work for an organization and feel the same stuff I feel out in the streets. But it's like that. It's even worse in here. Like I said, I've left these meetings crying. There's even, like, even on the streets, and I know because I sold drugs, I did it all. Even on the streets, there's a code of, like, respect. Like, even on the streets, it's just there. It's just stuff you don't do. And never on the streets, and somebody came up to me and said, you ain't black, or your blackness is in question. And you know, it's like, people said stuff to me here that I wouldn't have never heard on the street. So we like to think about the hood and the ghetto as like the worst bottom-up place, but there's still a level of dignity that's there that people don't even recognize. And in organizations, your gloves are off, right? Because I'm used to surviving out there. That's how I came up. But when I come to this, I took my armor off because I'm here to learn, right? So I don't have my armor on. And I'm sitting in a board meeting next to a woman who clearly don't know why she don't like me. She just don't like me. Sitting next to me, and she say, "What's your fat ass laughing at?" In a board meeting at the Alliance Against Racism and Political Oppression. And the old me, or if I was in the streets, you wouldn't even talk to me like that. You wouldn't go up down the street and say that to any, like, young person or whatever. But you felt like you could say that to me. Because you know my armor's off. You recognize I'm here to learn. You know that. You just don't understand why you don't like me. But you say that to me, and then to have everybody else just be quiet, you know? And have one white person speak up and say, "You're totally out of line." That's crazy. That's crazy. I called my sister, and my sister was like, "What the? You didn't go off? You didn't do this?" I'm like, "Nope, I didn't." "You have changed." I was like, "Yes." So just knowing that we got to be careful. We got to check each other, you know? And white people have to do it to each other and us. Because I'll see white people checking each other on stuff. Like, you know, "Judy, you're way out of line," and blah, blah, blah. "And that's racist," or whatever. But then when a black person does, it's like, they don't say nothing. They kind of like, they leave the meeting hurt, or something happened and they know they should have said something and they don't. I'm like, we all got to be in this. If we're in this work and we're working towards real change, we got to be willing to speak up and step out and say, "Look, this can't happen." And I'm not, you know, and I think it's not enough of that. And so all these sides are created. I'm on this person's side, or I'm with this group. I don't like this person on this board, so I don't even talk to this group. You know, like, and it's not productive, because we're losing. We're the minority. Like, we're losing the majority because people can't come into our work easily. Especially if you ain't from here. Now, I always said, attributed my stuff to, like, I'm not from here. You know?
Not just for this work, but just in this area generally, it's such a tight click.
It is.
You know. Oh,
and I was like, okay. And so a lot of times I know, like, stuff like this, that's why I'm like emailing you, like, "Did you talk to these people? Because, you know, people get, it's so sensitive, right? You know? And I think about it, like, wait a minute, this needs to happen. It needs to be somebody speaking up. Because sometimes you need that outside. A lot of people here I learned locally feel like outside people come in and they just got it made. I don't know if that's the truth. I think we come in with a different mind perspective. We come in to do things different and we get different results. But I think there's some stuff that we got to deal with. There's racism. There's all that stuff that's across the board. Gender issues. The fact that there's not a lot of people of color who are heading up organizations here. All of that stuff is there. But I'm telling them, that been there. Y'all been dealing with that. And instead of, like, attacking that, you attack the workers and the people on the organizing level that come in. You attack them critically instead of going after what the bigger problem is. And then, you know, it's not a lot of support for staff. And a lot of organizations don't have a lot of staff. And it's like, people attack the staff. I used to tell people, and then I said, because I was trying to understand why, and it might be just the psychologist in me. I do believe in behavioral stuff, but I just was trying to understand, what's the issue? Why do a lot of longtime volunteers, longtime board members attack the staff so much, you know? And, or just have issues with the staff. And I was thinking, like, man, they think it's the glory. They think it's a glory position that you get invited to all these things. You eat the same old chicken dinners at all these things. And you get to go to these events. And you're like, you get to do, and that's the life to them. To them, I said, people want to be paid for their passions, right? They feel like they're passionate. She just went to school and she just trying to get a job. But I'm passionate about this organization. And people want to get paid for those passions. And so then you see a person in a staff position who you think is not engaged enough. And people did that even with at the white org at KFTC with Colette, who isn't from here either. But because she's not at a lot of things, like, she don't care. She's not at a lot of meetings. She's this and that. And people make those assumptions. But I think some folks just get really jealous with staff because, or just upset because they want to be paid for that. They want the tickets. They want to be at the press conferences. They want to, you know? And it's like, at the end of the day, what does that stuff mean? Like, you know, I understand. I believe in using media as a tool, but not that I don't feel like that something ain't successful because press didn't show up. You know what I mean? Like, we should give the press the news. We shouldn't have them, like, choosing to us. But if you're catering your stuff so that the press can come, then they're going to see it and they're going to be like, no, you know? So it's a lot of that here. And people don't feel like the work is really recognized unless it's in the news or on the radio. And that's not true. You know, I made an assumption because Anne, one of the rare times I get her to talk about her life, because I would just want to hear. And I lived on 24th and Jefferson, and I was taking Anne somewhere, and she asked me where I live at, and so I drove where I lived at. And she said that so we went around the corner, and apparently Carl, his family, and all of them had this church that's around the corner from where I lived. They had been baptized there and all this other stuff. And she said that that same church, she went in, that Carl's priest, Carl's dad tried to name him Karl Marx. And then tried to name his brother Marx Carl or something like that. And that he was like, no, you can't do that. But apparently she was riding around the community and she was like, it's changed, you know? That the Bradens had a really strong history in the Portland community and around union stuff and all of that. And then I was like, yeah, you know? And it was right after I went to a Metro Council meeting. It was the first time I spoke at this Metro Council, but I spoke about police abuse. And it was right after the riots and all that stuff had happened in Cincinnati, the most recent riots and all that. I think I spoke to that and I spoke about what had been going on. And it was crazy because when I came out my door, these guys, they were always out drinking, like 10 in the morning. I come in from here, it's like 10 at night. They're just out on the porch, you know, drinking whatever. And I just figured, they don't do nothing but drink, you know? And then one day, after I drop in, I think it was the next day, I get out of my car, come home, I get out the car. And the guy was like, yeah, I saw you on the Access Channel. You were speaking about police abuse. And I was like, whoa. He was like, I know that you went through this and I know you did that. And that's good. We've been saying something. I had no idea that they even watched that channel. You know, who watches Metro Government TV, you know? And I was just amazed. So I think this notion that we think that everybody is just disengaged and don't care about the work or whatever, I think it's false. I think they just need, we all need different levels to get involved. And maybe we're not inspiring them enough in some ways, you know? And so that's it. I just thought, I always want to be surprised. Like, I like to be surprised. And I think that we got so much work to do. Yeah, so that's it.
Thank you.
I will talk to you to death, Amber.
Thank you.
But thank you. So was it everything?